Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hey, thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie, HRN Executive Director, and I'm so excited to share with you our coverage from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
We are here live today at Charleston Wine and Food.
Join us as we talk all things food.
Come to Charleston, eat some seafood. Eat all of the seafood.
Chicken fried chicken with chorizo steak and salsa verde mashed potatoes.
So quintessentially like Southern fare at its finest.
And have important conversations.
We're also talking about professional women in restaurants and how underrepresented they are. People of color in restaurants and how they're not talked about.
We get real with Food Network's Manit Chauhan.
Balance is BS. I was told that I wasn't going to be bleeped out.
And find out about raising sugarcane with Chef Sean Brock.
It's like being Indiana Jones or something. You never know what you're going to find.
You'll come away inspired by the power of food and the food scene in Charleston. Here's Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Food is constantly in flux. Food is always moving. Food is the only real lingua franca that we have that allows us to connect with other folks.
So tune in to Heritage Radio Network on tour at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't go wrong.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at our borders in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is John McCarthy, who is a former lawyer with 20 years of experience. He successfully made a dramatic career change and became a chef. In 2012, he opened the Crimson Sparrow in Hudson Valley and earned a great reputation. And he joined me on episode 29 and talked all about his life journey and his restaurant. And in July last year, 2017, John opened another beautiful Japanese-influenced restaurant called Oka in Murray Hill in Manhattan. John frequently visits Japan and even started to speak Japanese frequently. And through building and managing two successful Japanese-influenced restaurants, he keeps discovering interesting new flavors of Japanese cuisine. So today we'll discuss John's idea of Japanese cuisine and the fascinating concept of his new restaurant, Oka, his recent trip to Japan to study wagashi or Japanese sweets, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. And you can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Now let's start our conversation with John McCarthy. Hello, John. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here. Almost 100 episodes later.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to the next one already. Okay, so first of all, for listeners who have not listened to episode 29, could you tell us your background?
Sure, and shame on them. They should download all of these past episodes and listen to them. Fascinating people. I do listen to them quite often. Background. I just opened Oka 5 months ago, 6 months ago, in Murray Hill. Before that, we had a restaurant up in Hudson, New York, called The Crimson Sparrow. The two concepts are quite different. In the Hudson Valley, we were doing a tasting menu. We had an a la carte bar food type program as well. But the one in Murray Hills is much more casual,
right.
Inspired by the izakaya of Japan that are, places where people go to drink and eat, that kind of thing.
So you're going to detail on that later.
Oh, but you want to know about me. I hate talking about me.
I can ask you some questions.
No, that's okay. So I grew up, the real quick sketch is I grew up in Maryland, spent 3 years in Korea,
when
South
Korea.
When
you was high school?
High school. And then came back, went to college, went to law school, worked as a lawyer in Delaware, Tennessee, New York. Always wanted to be in the restaurant industry. And at some point, I can't pinpoint the exact day, but decided I'd had enough. And went to then French Culinary Institute. I think it's now the ICC, International Culinary Center.
Mm-hmm.
Left there, went to work for Wiley Dufresne at WD-50, then left there and opened the Crimson Sparrow. So that's the long and short.
Right. What a journey. I think you are in Korea at your very formative years of high school,
13 till I was almost 17.
Right. So that's how you got familiar with Asian culture, including Japanese cuisine.
Yeah. And when I was in Korea, we traveled quite a bit. Japan, Philippines, Taiwan, Hong Kong. My parents were incredibly, energetic that way. And it really, it sort of starts a bug in someone, once you travel, once you taste different things, you want more of it.
Mm.
I remember my parents telling me that, don't worry about school. If you miss a day or two, traveling is much more of an education. And they were exactly right.
Mm, right. Okay.
I don't recommend dropping out of school and traveling, but if you have the opportunity,
right.
You should travel.
Right, because you can study, but you cannot travel anytime you want. So that's
right.
The more you grow up, you realize taking vacation.
Oh, I realize.
Right. Okay. And so you closed the Crimson Sparrow to open Hoka in Manhattan, but you got a great reputation for the quality of food and the unique concept of the Crimson Sparrow. So what kind of food did you serve at the Crimson Sparrow?
Well, like I said, we started out doing an a la carte menu, and about a year in, I think it was a year anniversary, we decided, why don't we offer a tasting menu? And some people had asked us about it because we came from a background where we did a tasting menu. I think there were some people who were somewhat confused by the menu, how they should order.
Mm.
And I tell the story, I think that first weekend we offered it, 98% of the people ordered the tasting menu. So it made it kind of easy to transition into that type of a concept.
Right.
The type of food was really, how to describe it? It was small plates. We grew the tasting menu from, it was about 7 courses. And, towards the end we were doing, at one point we did 2 different menus, 7 courses, 12 courses. It was somewhere between 10 and 12 courses.
Right.
So, small plates, focusing on a particular ingredient, hopefully. We were able to get something for several dishes that would be local.
Mm.
We were located within a mile of 2 farms, and then there were several other farms up there that were located within 2 or 3 miles.
Right. So I'd imagine, sounds like, that time when you opened Crimson Sparrow, it was 2012, and then up until the next couple of years, it's more like tasting menu focused restaurants open up all over the place. And it's to me, it's more like kaiseki cuisine, courses after courses and 10, 12 dishes.
I think the comparison is not unfair in terms of the concept, because you're in that tasting menu, what we were trying to do was, offer something that was vegetable-based, farm-based in the beginning of the menu, then offering something that was a bit more substantial and include something grilled or steamed, and then to finish with a larger format plate. And then the desserts, we tried to draw just sort of inspiration from Japanese or Asian flavors. There's some Korean elements that do make it into my food as well, because I did eat a fair bit of it for a couple of years, and it did make an impression.
Okay. Yes, I asked that, the kaiseki word, because now I'm going to talk about oka, because oka.
Let's talk about oka.
Yeah, let's talk about oka, because you opened oka in July last year, and some media people called it izakaya, not kaiseki. And that's a confusion, because you don't want to call it izakaya, right? So can you just elaborate on the concept of oka?
Sure. Kaiseki, omakase, connote, denote sort of a set menu, a tasting menu, or a chef's choice on the menu. The concept of, the general concept of izakaya, encompassing what is an izakaya in Japan. Izakaya are usually smaller, more informal places where you can go and drink shochu, sake, beer, highballs. They offer smaller plates to accompany the food. Those types of places, the energy is really, I think, great. Much more akin to, say, an Irish pub or, a busy tapas lounge where people are going to get a drink, socialize, either at lunch or after work or whatever the case may be. But, it's a very convivial atmosphere. And so the idea was to take the concept of an izakaya, take the Japanese flavors and ingredients that I enjoy, and maybe some of the dishes that I've had, push them through, the prism of my mind, and change them up a little bit, make them more identifiable with me, not of Japanese food and not of Japanese izakaya. Because, you and I talked about it. I don't want someone going to Japan and saying, oh my God, it's my first time in Japan. I had this Japanese dish of ikura and yeasted sunchoke puree. Can I have that? And, no one's going to understand that. But the idea is to take the best parts and concepts of an izakaya and kind of recreate it the best we can in oka.
So sounds like the definition of izakaya for you is the energy and approachable dishes.
Sure, and we also strive to have, much like an izakaya in Japan, an izakaya here in New York. There's some fantastic izakaya in New York. We try to offer what we think is a strong and very delicious sake menu. We have a pretty good shochu selection. We're trying to grow that as the customers come to us and learn about shochu. And we have an incredible selection of Japanese whiskeys, mainly from Suntory, and also a great selection of Japanese beers.
Right. So opening izakaya in Manhattan is something you wanted to do because you moved and not in Hudson. So it's just...
I was doing a lot of these dishes in Hudson as part of sort of our more informal bar menu. And so when the opportunity from my partner, Simon Shee, came up, we talked about the concept that we thought would fit in Murray Hill, which, Murray Hill is a young professional-driven neighborhood. We, agreed that it should be sort of like an izakaya, a bit more informal, no tablecloths. We offer chopsticks and paper napkins, but we wanted the food to be accessible, but also, quite interesting. And I think we've achieved that balance. I mean, it's only 6 months in, so,
right.
We're still striving to find sort of the sweet spot for the menu and what people like.
Right. But, the interior of oka is somewhat minimalist. And it could be fine dining, but the energy is open kitchen and energy from servers and the chef. And it's a really fun place to be, too.
I appreciate that. I've actually had people sit down and say, I thought this would be more formal. It's very different in its concept. The appearance of it's going to fill out a little bit. But the appearance of it, yes, could be construed as formal, but there's nothing formal about our service, nothing formal about the food. And when I say formal, I mean super fine dining.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my staff is incredibly friendly. You know, they want to have as much fun as the guests. You know, they're at right. work, but they don't want to work. they want it to feel like work. They're right. doing a hard job. They do it well, and they do it with a smile. And that's kind of the atmosphere we really want to push
forward. Right.
I've
been there a couple of times. So I laughed loud with your service a couple of times already. So, right. Okay. And Oka, by the way, means a hill.
Hill.
Murray Hill.
That's correct. It right. was that name was given to me by Chris Johnson, the Saki Ninja.
Mm.
We were bouncing around names, and it fits because, you know, Hill, Murray Hill, and, you know, so.
Right. And I think, you know, you are from Maryland. You're not born in Japan, but to me,
I am not Japanese.
But the way you express your dishes, like, I tasted your dishes, and then it doesn't look like Japanese at all, but somehow it tastes Japanese. So maybe you can just give us some examples of your dishes.
Yeah, sure. You know, I don't cook traditional Japanese food. However, there are elements within it that would be considered traditional. For example, dashi. You know, we make dashi in a very traditional way, kombu, you know, and bonito, and, you know, cook it as per the recipe of Chef Yoshihiro Murata in Kyoto. And so, you know, there are aspects that are traditional, but the final presentation is not likely to be construed as traditional.
Mm.
you've eaten the food as well. I mean, I say it's the best compliment, but then I think about it. Just, you know, for example, if you sat down and ate the dashi or drank, you know, had a bowl of dashi, and you said, "Oh my goodness, John, this tastes exactly like my grandmother made it," and then just left it there, I'd have to ask myself, "Well, was your mom a good cook, or a bad?" What, is that a good thing or a bad thing? But you know, there are things you will recognize.
Mm.
We do have a tonkatsu on the menu, but it is a bit different.
Mm.
The accompaniments are different. The dressing for the cabbage, there's dressing on the
cabbage. Let's talk about the tonkatsu. Yeah. Is basically fried pork.
Right.
And it's like an izakaya regular item in Japan too. And it's fried, and it's like a fried chicken, kind of approachable.
Yeah, I heard that. I heard that commercial before we got on. It said chicken fried chicken. I don't know what chicken fried chicken is, but I wouldn't mind it. It sounds good. but yeah, we have pork tonkatsu, which is a fried pork cutlet. We serve it with a yuzu vinaigrette dressed Napa cabbage and our own tonkatsu sauce. And then we also have karaage, fried chicken. And, you know, both preparations, I mean, we take time to brine our pork and make sure that we bread it a day ahead. There's reasons for that. The fried chicken, we actually, you know, kind of cure it for a bit with koji. And then we buttermilk brine it for at least 2 days, and then
I like that koji marinade.
We just recently started doing that about maybe 3-4 weeks ago. I've been following with great interest guys like Jeremy Umansky out in.
So listeners who are not familiar with koji, what is koji?
Aspergillus oryzae. It's man, I didn't know this was going to be a science program.
Oh, it's like a beginner's version,
six-year-old's version. It is a bacteria, spore?
Or mold or whatever. Mold, like, something like live and small and active.
Yeah, I'm trying to pick and choose my words, of course, on live radio so that people aren't freaked out by it. Yeah, it essentially, for our purposes in the chicken, the way it changed it, is we're finding that it causes the chicken to be more juicy, to remain moist. And it's such a distinct difference that every single person in our restaurant that works there sees the difference. So, you know, it's things like this that we're continuing to grow and evolve and learning from other chefs like Chef Jeremy out in Cleveland. You know, these are things that probably are well known to Japanese people, just not really well known.
Well, there's a huge boom of koji because I actually made koji by myself. I grew it and then marinated my chicken overnight, and it just changed dramatically.
Almost sweet, right?
Yeah, and then I think the amino acid in koji breaks everything down, and then more flavorful, more softer and juicier. And I couldn't believe that I made it. So, yeah,
just so people know, koji, the yellow koji we're talking about, is used to make miso, sake, soy sauce, you know, a myriad of things. So it's not something that, you know, we're out using that no one's used before. This is really well known.
Well, everything fermented in Japan tend to be made out of koji.
Absolutely. Right?
And I'm hoping there's one gentleman in Japan. There are only six companies who make koji in Japan. So I'm trying to have one of them sometime in the near future. But anyway, so koji, you make koji and at your restaurant. That means to me, that's essentially Japanese. So that part is really respect. The way you decide to create your menu in your way of Japanese cuisine.
Yeah, you know, by the way, these are things that we don't discuss with people at the tables, but we're, you know, unless they ask, but we're trying to do it so that it tastes good to us. And you know, this is, it's fun to talk about, but at the end of the day, I just want people to really enjoy the chicken and say, wow, that was the best damn chicken I've ever had.
Yeah, and one of the dishes, I think it's really, you mentioned earlier, the salmon roe, and East it's sancho puree and chips. That looks very Western.
But it's the only dish that made it from the Crimson Sparrow menu to oka in its form. You know, the idea of that dish was really sort of Sunday morning, bagels and lox. And, you know, I figured, okay, if we yeast the sunchoke, it'll taste a bit like bread and, you know, roe instead of cured salmon. I'll say the people that like it really like it. They love it. There are some people who just maybe haven't had something so yeasted or even had sunchoke before. But at least they're familiar with the roe.
Right, and it's beautiful too.
Thank you.
Right. Okay. So yeah. And by the way, you mentioned earlier about your beverage programs, and you have a sake sommelier license too.
From SSI.
Right. So that's why you have a huge emphasis on beverage. And
and I like sake. Yeah. And I love shochu.
Yeah. And you have whiskey too.
Yes.
I counted you have 27 sake, 8 shochu, and Japanese whiskey, which is becoming very popular now, the four of them. So in a way, that's izakaya.
I hope so. But it's also from the perspective of why did we select the sake? It's because it goes well with the food that we're making. You know, sort of the fun, but we've introduced flights of sake. We have 4 flights of sake. And those 4 flights are actually flights that we recommend to guests when they order certain dishes. So it's not just, hey, taste these 3 flights. We're actually going to push you a little bit towards some dishes. You know, I have a great great staff that's very energetic and very eager to learn, and they learn these sakes and they learn the profile. So if you have questions, just ask them. They will point you in the right direction.
Right, and very proudly, and I can tell they like their products too.
They love training.
And by tasting.
Exactly.
Right. And so, as I said at the beginning of the show, you go to Japan pretty often. And so you even started at the sushi restaurant in Tokyo a while ago. Right?
Staged.
Right.
Yeah. Just for, five weeks, I think it was.
Right. But those
longest 5 weeks of working I think I'd done.
Right. Yeah,
it's a grueling schedule. Sushi restaurants have the utmost respect for sushi chefs. You know, up at 4:30 in the morning, at Tsukiji Market by 5:30, back at the restaurant by 7, butchering fish until 10, 11 to 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock lunch service, a 1-hour nap, clean up, dinner, do it all over again after midnight. It's 6 days a week. It is grueling. So Tip your sushi chefs.
Wow. So, Yeah, so based on that kind of experience, also at this point, you have built and run two successful Japanese influence restaurants. So how do you describe the level of understanding Japanese cuisine in this country?
I can only speak to New York, and you know some other places that I've been that I know quite well. But you know, I sort of expressed to you at times there's a bit of a frustration level. Frustration being that through either accessibility, marketing, proliferation, it seems to be that there is a segment of people who think that the only Japanese food that exists is either sushi and or ramen. And there is so much more. My recent trip to Japan, I was there for 2 weeks. I dedicated myself to one bowl of ramen because I wanted to try other things. You know, yakitori, tempura, sukiyaki. I mean, there is so much other food that is available that I don't think people have a full appreciation even exists.
Mm.
You know, the funny story, they come to Oka, people look at the menu and say, oh, thought you were a Japanese restaurant. Oh, what were you looking for? Sushi. Well, we have fish. No, I was looking for California roll. It doesn't make sense to me. But there seems to be a very linear approach to Japanese food. And this is an entire cuisine that's been designated by UNESCO as a World Heritage Treasure.
Mm.
There's more to it than ramen and sushi,
right,
which I enjoy both of them. I love them. But, you know, for me, I was talking to Jamie Graves. He was on your program. If I had my choice, yakitori would probably be way, way up the list.
Mm.
Unagi, Jamie was saying, I agree. There's so much more to it than sushi and ramen.
Mm.
You know, it's much like saying, hey, let's go eat American food, and then someone drags you to McDonald's every time. You know, so there's much to explore with Japanese food. And the most recent trip was triggered by the fact that I met a chef in New York named Mori Masafumi, who is quite a well-known wagashi chef in Japan.
Yeah, so we'll talk about in the next segment. But the people think about Japanese cuisine as sushi or ramen, and it's interesting, right? Because it used to be that I think I heard after World War II, people didn't eat sushi, and now Nobu opened. Oh wow, just fashionable, stylish, and healthy. And then even Delhi has sushi, packaged sushi, and Whole Foods, of course, and it's great. But I think that's the bad part. It's too famous that people don't think of anything else. And
it's proliferation. And I think you're right. I think a lot of it is, it's sushi, so it must be healthy for me. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a go-to. And that's fine. I think the more omega-3s you eat from salmon, the better for you. But I think what I'm a little, I don't know, I wish people would branch out just a little more. You know, Japanese. When you think Japanese food, it seems that there's a reflex to only be sushi. And I think there's much, much more to explore that I think people would enjoy. If you will eat raw fish, I think there's a lot of other Japanese food you might like as well, because you're obviously a bit more adventurous and you'll probably enjoy some of the things that, you know, Japanese people like.
Mm.
I think we talked about it. I mean, Japanese people in Japan don't eat that much sushi.
It's once a month.
Once a month. So, you know, it's not an everyday occurrence. You know, even ramen, it may be once a week, but the other days, you know, tsukemen or udon or something other than ramen will be the fare.
Right.
So there's a much, you know, obviously Japanese people know Japanese food.
Right.
But, you know, Americans, I think, need to learn that there is something other than ramen and sushi.
Right.
But, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, you know, when I go to Japan, I look for lunch places where you have white rice and miso soup and a baked fish. It's like the lunch set menu, $10, with some pickles and some vegetables. It's just the best value, and you feel amazing.
I went to a similar place in Himeji, right outside of Himeji Castle. I think they call it Nama Tamago type restaurant. You get a bowl of rice. They come by. They give you literally a bowl of raw eggs. You crack one in your rice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you eat the
that's
egg.
That's the one I grew up when I was little.
you literally can hear the chickens behind the restaurant. Mm. And you get along with it. You know, either some dried fish or pickles or whatever the case may be, but it's delicious.
Right. Yeah, so it's I think partly the information about Japanese cuisine is not, well, distributed enough. I have to work harder. But yeah, that's the thing. That's also in this country, there are what's called the Japanese restaurants. In Japan, there's no Japanese restaurant. It's either, I mean, kaiseki or kappo, that's like, you know, right. It's more like broader range, but they have a specific style. Otherwise, you go to tempura, sushi, yakitori, or kushiyage, all those places.
Exactly. I mean, kushiyage is a great example in Osaka. You know, we can talk about that as well. But, you know, it's fried things on a stick, which I think would be a huge, a hugely accepted product here in America. You know, entire state fairs are built around a hot dog on a stick that's battered and fried. This is not a foreign concept. So I think there is a place for that type of food. You know, the concern, I talked to some Japanese people who were like, well, would Americans eat fried food? And my response was, well, if they didn't, the colonel would not be as successful as he is. So right. I think there's a place for all of it. And you don't have to eat it every day.
Right.
You know, these are things that, you know, if you enjoy Japanese cuisine, you could have a different type of cuisine for, you know, 2 weeks.
Right. The other thing, as you know, as you are a restaurant operator, so, you know, if you have 8-seat restaurants, which is very common in Japan, and then this minimum, this owner and his wife, or maybe a server, and then make... Like, if you go to an expensive tempura place, you might pay $100 or $150, but then there's no extra cost, and the rent is cheaper because it's small. Mm-hmm. But that person is an expert. So if you want to have a good tempura, you go to the place. And in Japan, in Japanese phrase, there's a saying, mochi wa mochi ya, means make mochi specialty, make mochi, meaning leave it to the specialist. So I think that's the concept of restaurant in Japan. And here, because you have to have major box, like especially here in New York City, and I heard if it's in less than 60 seats, it's hard to make money. Something like that. So
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, so it's just a different mindset. So, you know, someone like you who's patiently trying to educate diners with some more broad idea of Japanese cuisine, I really feel... You know, you're amazing.
Well, I mean, I'm having fun with it as well, but also, I mean, to be humble, I mean, I'm trying to learn myself. This is why I do go back to Japan. This is why I do eat things that, you know, I probably wouldn't gravitate towards, you know, but I, in order to push myself to taste and see different things, you have to do it. It's the learning part of it. The journey is fun.
Right. What does you have a kama, right? The collar?
We serve, yes, yellowtail hamachi collar, kama.
So I don't know how many listeners know what's kama. Like
it is the collar of a hamachi fish.
So yellowtail have a collar? Like I have no idea, right? Like if you don't know what it is, it's crazy. You have no clue.
Exactly. And it's the second best-selling dish at Oka. And there are a fair number of people who, when it hits their table, are like, what is this? Because they had a perception that hamachi would be presented differently, sliced probably. But we grill the collar. We baste it with and glaze it with a seasoned soy glaze. And then it's basted with yuzu. And it's finished with... citrus, yuzu kosho.
It's this kama is between head and kind of like a neck part, but there's like a dish of bones, and there's like a chunk of meat
there's
sitting
there. There's a
bunch
of cartilage in it, you know, and people enjoy it. It is incredibly delicious. So I think that there are a fair number of people who have ordered it, not known what it is, gotten into it and said, man, I got to have one of those again.
Right.
But I also appreciate the people that haven't had it before, knew what it was, but wanted to learn how to eat it.
Mm.
And I sell a lot of kama. Right.
And by the way, if you go to Japanese supermarkets in Japan or Tsukiji market even, it's pretty expensive.
It is expensive. You know, we're able to offer, I think, at a really reasonable price. I mean, it's a lot of food, but the way we prepare it has a great flavor, great grilled flavor, and I think that's why it's so popular.
Mm. And the other way you educate people, you had a French chef from Osaka who had a collaboration dinner of kushiyage.
Yeah, we actually had two chefs from Osaka. This was probably around 3 months ago. I had eaten at his restaurant in Osaka, Kushiyagi 010. Mm. And when I went back most recently, I ate there again and also at Yakitori Ichimatsu. The chef at Kushiyagi 010 is Kentaro Murakami. And, you know, the tasting menu, omakase, that he offers is incredible.
Mm.
Things that I had never thought of putting together in terms of flavors, but also how light the fried items were.
Right. Because it includes some vegetables, some sequence of
seafood, vegetables, and meat.
Mm.
And really, really interesting and innovative presentation. So we had him here.
Right. And the batter has to be art, right? Like make it light and crisp.
Yeah, the funny story was as he came to Oka and then looked at our panko, And you could just see he did not like the panko. So he asked me what other types, and with an S, how many other types of panko I had. And I said, I don't. So we had to roboku some, ground some, mix some. We came up with the right mix for him.
Mm.
But it was incredible because they anticipated about 30 portions of kushiyage.
Mm.
I thought it would be a bit more. We ended up doing almost three times as many. Wow. And it was an incredible turnout by Japanese people who I think missed that type of food, who remembered it from Japan and knew that that night at Oka, it was going to be the only type of food that was served for the special occasion. Mm. And the turnout was incredible. And I think the people that, you know, they knew, they kind of looked it up. Fried things, delicious fried things on a stick.
Mm.
That turned out for it, they also thought it was delicious.
Right.
So,
because it's this covers best seasonal ingredients with the best butter, which is art of the chef. Absolutely. And then the fries with the original good choice of oil and absolutely perfectly heated. So it's a very Japanese idea, but it's a perfect, you can do it anytime.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Even my parents can, my mom can cook too. So
it's incredibly delicious. Right. And you know, it lies in that, I think, really just a sort of a fun comfort food type of experience.
Right. To perfect it, it's hard. But
yeah, perfection. yeah, it's a lot harder than it sounds and looks.
Right. Okay. So you've been introducing all those new things to New York diners. And then, so we'll take a quick break. But when we come back, John is trying to do something new, which is wagashi. That's Japanese sweets. So we'll talk about it. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is John McCarthy, who is a chef, who's a chef owner of the beautiful Japanese-influenced restaurant called Oka in Murray Hill, Manhattan, which opened in July last year. So in March last year, you spent some time in Japan to study wagashi, or Japanese sweets. So how did it happen?
So when was it? January, we had a chef visit from Japan, Mori Masafumi. He owns a confections shop called Amaneya Kamada. And he was brought to the restaurant by Tama Shimada Bocher, who is a great chef in her own right. And during the course of his visit, we started talking about wagashi. And it was a very interesting conversation, and it took place over the course of several hours. And the end result of it was that he wanted me to come to Japan to see what he does, see his shop, see the production, and just kind of learn a little bit more about wagashi. And I was very interested because my exposure to wagashi was probably what every other person's exposure was, which is they go to Kyoto and then there's a wagashi shop everywhere, every 5 feet. And, you taste it, you eat it. They look beautiful. Mm. They're artistic. And then you eat it and then you gravitate towards the ones you like. Mm. So I was very curious about it. And, I was fortunate enough to go over there and spend some time with Mori-san and see his facility, actually get my hands involved in some of it, but also more just to learn about the, we'll call it the art of wagashi. I think it is an art.
Mm, right. Okay, so that's interesting that the Japanese traditional confectionery maker comes to New York and then try to educate you. So
yeah, he had actually, I think, I forget where else he went, but he got around quite a bit.
Mm.
And 2 weeks before I went to see him, Chef David Belay went to go see him and visited his shop as well. So, his work is amazing.
Mm.
Really pretty delicious. Absolutely delicious.
Right. Well, the wagashi is, people say it's less sugary, which I'm not sure about. But there's no cream or butter too much. Almost none.
Yeah, I think it can be as sweet as Americans like it, but it doesn't have maybe the richness because of the lack of butter and cream.
Mm.
I don't know. It is sweet.
Right. But like you said, it's stunningly beautiful. I think it's probably because, Japan is such a gift-oriented culture and the wagashi shops are thriving still. Mm. Along with all those other cake shops and Western sweet shops, because it's so beautiful that
it
you
is.
Want to give it to someone.
Exactly. I mean, it's really one of those foods that I think people get things and they go, oh my God, this is too beautiful to eat. That might actually be true with some of the wagashi. They're making food that is directly reflective of place, time, season, and trying to be in harmony with nature.
Right.
And if you've ever watched any of these programs where they're doing that, it's really incredible. And, Mori-san spent, I think, 12 years, he told me, apprenticing. So that's a long time.
Mm.
And, that's what it takes, I think, to do wagashi at that level.
Right. So, and you mentioned the seasonal ingredients, and that's why it's used for kaiseki tea ceremony, the tea ceremony. And it's the reflection of now, this moment, right? So, yeah, it's just beyond just sweets to consume.
I think every wagashi in Japan right now is pink, right?
For it was terrible. For Sakura.
You right. see so much pink wagashi right now.
Right. So the Mori-san apprentice 12 years probably to learn the sequence of the seasons. But the wagashi can be very casual, like daifuku.
Mm-hmm. That absolutely.
Yeah, so what's daifuku? I heard you learned something about that too.
Well, I mean, what I was trying to learn from Mori-san was not so much specific. You know, we tasted his dango, his mitarashi. Mm-hmm. He made the sauce for me because I was particularly interested in that. Some use of kudzu, mm-hmm. Which I think is a fascinating product. And also texturally, it yields things that I like.
Mm, that's just the starch, but
it's a starch,
right? It's just plant root, and then I think it makes more chewier,
a little chewier
than agar agar,
right? Which is a little more can be chewy, but it's a little more brittle.
Mm.
But the kudzu is very interesting, and so. You know, during the course of my time there, I think I told you the one thing that I saw that it fascinated me was he makes his ichigo daifuku, which is strawberry. Strawberry anko, which is a white, and then anko is a white paste, bean paste.
Right, anko can be white or red. Right, so that was the white one.
He uses white.
Right.
Mm. And then the outer layer, instead of just being mochi, was actually a marshmallow mochi.
Mm, that's genius.
It was really incredible. It was like a chewy, really chewy marshmallow.
Wow.
And it was fascinating. Really, how he made it, and then also the texture with the strawberry. Really, really incredible.
So it's because it's a marshmallow in it. Incorporated, it's more fluffier.
It's fluffier. Mm. It's much softer. It's actually, when you touch it, it's almost like a cotton ball. It's really quite interesting. It was incredibly delicious. I ate more than a couple of those.
Can you make that here?
Well, I think I ate more than a couple because I would try to actually assemble them, and he'd say, "Oh, that one's yours." And I don't know if he was giving it to me because he wanted me to taste it, or it just didn't look right. So, if the amount that I ate or it was an indication of the quality of my product, then I probably wasn't that good at it. But we're going to try to do something at Oka, sort of as an introduction for the guests.
Mm.
I probably won't sell them. It'll be more of like a pedophore or something so that, it triggers a conversation so that people understand it. I also want to help Mori-san into promotion of wagashi and him, so we'll have information available about him because I think some payback to him for showing me, and he's invited me back to Himeji for further study or staging, and I may take him up on it.
Mm,
beautiful town, Himeji. First time I was there, incredible castle.
Mm. So that's near, relatively close to Osaka.
It's about an hour train ride, I think.
Right, it's not too far.
Not too far at all.
Right, wow.
I think it's a city of about 500,000 people.
Really?
So it feels like a town, but it's actually a city.
Mm. Okay, so I can't wait to see your petit four, Doka. Right. But congratulations on your progress. Each time I see you, you have something new. And it's very exciting.
Congratulations to you! After 100 more, this has become so much, and so natural, easy.
Thank you, but I think I have to work harder to let people know about Japanese cuisine.
Open a restaurant, Akiko.
Oh yeah. Well, maybe we can open another one together. Okay. So So please keep us posted, and
we'll do.
Yeah. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
great to be here.
Yeah, so thank you, John, for joining us again. Okay, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradio.org or akikatema.com. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradio.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And our engineer is David Tatasciore. And thank you for listening. I will see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.